Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The United States and North Korea are drifting toward war perhaps as early as this year, warned President Bill Clinton's Defense Secretary William Perry. In a pointed interview with the Washington Post last week, he's not the only prominent Korea watcher ringing alarm bells. Mohammed El-Baradei, director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, is calling the situation in North Korea the most immediate and most serious threat of nuclear proliferation on the planet. On Sunday, the New York Times reported there is strong evidence North Korea has built a second secret plant for producing weapons-grade plutonium. That allegation comes 11 days after North Korea announced it has completed reprocessing 8,000 fuel rods, enough to make half a dozen nuclear weapons. Tonight on Point, the crisis Washington does not need, North Korea and America's quickening drift toward war. Are you following the signs, the warnings? Is the Bush administration being forthright about the North Korean threat? And can the United States accept a nuclear-armed North Korea? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Paul Bracken, professor of management and political science at Yale University. He wrote the book Fire in the East about the mounting military buildup in Asia. Good evening and welcome, Professor Paul Bracken.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. And with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
Paul Bracken, thanks for being with us tonight. I'm sure you read, as we all did, William Perry's comments on the threat from North Korea in North Korea last week. He says that, in his view, the United States had a chance 6 months ago to manage this, but that Washington has or is losing control of the nuclear proliferation situation, of the threat of conflict in Northeast Asia. What's your assessment? Do you agree?
I agree with Bill Perry about this is an extraordinarily dangerous situation. I guess maybe I could try to put a little more precision on it and say I don't think we've lost control. I think we have ratcheted up the pressure on North Korea, but for several months we have not really figured out where we're going to go next, number one. The second thing I would say is that I think there's been a kind of maybe too much loose talk coming out on the subject of nuclear counterproliferation by the administration. And here I'm referring to the loose talk about preemption, which I personally think sent shockwaves through the Pyongyang government, and I don't think was thought through by this government before they said it.
So you think that Washington has provoked North Korea, but what you're looking at is also put pressure on North Korea, but you're saying several months where Washington's policy has not been clear. How does that jibe with your observation of remarks that you call provocative?
Well, I think it jives pretty well, because you often find in complex organizations like governments, the right hand doesn't completely coordinated with the left hand. I think the way to think about this is imagine a ladder. And if you go up a rung in the ladder, that means putting pressure, increasing the intensity of the crisis mm-hmm. for the purpose of getting North Korea to back down. And that would be for them to open up and abandon their nuclear weapons program, allow inspection to take place and stop their program. And I think over the past 6 months, there's been a well-thought-out, coherent, systematic attempt to increase the pressure. For example, we have started a quasi-economic warfare program against North Korea. We have led to their diplomatic isolation. We've tried to assemble an international coalition. All of those things are for the good, in my judgment. The question is, where do you go from here? And too often, I think this is debated in terms of, you know, wildly jumping up this ladder to all-out war or military strikes. What we need to do is focus on two or three, four rungs of this ladder, what we will do in response to what they will do. So it's a very, this is an area where really fine-tuned distinctions may seem almost academic, but will in fact become very important.
Interpret a few of the things that we've heard in the last couple of days. First, it was just a dozen days ago or so, Pyongyang said, hey, we have reprocessed fuel from 8,000 fuel rods, enough for half a dozen nuclear weapons. A, do you believe that? B, why would they say that?
Let me take the last question, why they would say that. I think they say that because to them it makes a lot of sense. To us, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Why would they bluster and sort of, manipulate us to try to almost increase the pressure? It doesn't make any sense. I think this shows the huge cultural differences between the two sides. Now, on the other point, I think that the recent revelation that they may have a second site for reprocessing plutonium.
This is the New York Times story saying that there may be a secret second site, and this deduced from some kind of krypton blowing across the border being picked up on sensors along the DMZ in South Korea that suggest that the site that's been tracked for years is not the only production site.
Right. And now, let's emphasize, this is highly uncertain. However, I don't think you can find any serious student of North Korea who would be surprised by this if it existed. That we might differ on whether, you should jump to the conclusion that it in fact does exist. But the nature of that regime, the fact that they have built huge facilities underground for 30 and 40 years, this cannot be a surprise. Plus, the experience with our intelligence community is that they're not particularly strong on identifying weapons of mass destruction programs. And that's not a criticism. It's a very hard problem to fix.
But if this second production site exists, doesn't this really tie the Washington's hands on the preemptive strike front? The theory had been they could go after,
Yongbyon.
Right. Perhaps take it out or at least shut it down, and that would at least cut off the nuclear threat, if not the conventional threat. If there's a second location, does that checkmate Washington on the military front?
If it doesn't checkmate it, it makes that option extremely much less attractive for exactly the reasons you're outlining. Also, I would add, if there's a second site, the probability of having a third or a fourth site is very, very high.
William Perry says we are losing control, and he suggests that they may be cranking out more nukes by the end of this year and that would precipitate war.
That's really the question, is that it's all well and good to say that we want a peaceful diplomatic solution. But if that takes a long time and it doesn't happen and it gives North Korea the capacity to have 20 to 30 nuclear weapons, a lot of uncertainty around this to be sure, then a lot of people, including myself, would find that essentially intolerable. Now, I don't want to say that's a causus belli, a cause to go to war, but that is a enormous increase in North Korea climbing rungs of their ladder because it obviates, it makes it much harder for the United States to do to North Korea what we have done in Kosovo and against Iraq, that is to use our massive conventional superiority to overwhelm that regime. That's going to be a lot harder if they have 20 nuclear weapons.
Jack Beatty, at least two administrations have suggested that would be a casus belli, a cause for war. Bill Clinton was quite clear on that, and President Bush has suggested the same thing. He said that he will not tolerate a nuclear-armed North Korea.
Yes, and you have to wonder why the drift. What's the cycle here? I don't know anything about North Korea, but I think I know something about American politics. We had General Clark on, Wesley Clark, on our program several weeks ago, and when pressed, he said basically that the card Bush has to play politically is crisis, and that he said, General Clark did, that there are crises teed up all over the world. Well, we have provided the tee here. The North Koreans have the ball, but President Bush, with his provocative statements, the axis of evil, perhaps one of the most irresponsible statements in recent diplomacy, it seems to me, the statement by people quoted out of Cheney's office in the Washington Post, they want him dead, meaning Mr. North Korean dictator. The Rumsfeld redeployment, the talk about redeploying our forces from the vulnerable DLC down to the, south of Seoul, where they would be safer in the event of a strike. All of this with Mr. Bush losing, I think, about 12 points in the last 6 weeks in his approval rating. If he gets around 50%, and if the Democrats start to criticize him from the right, as they're almost certain to do, and Bill Perry is just doing it here, I think his original idea was, let this thing drift, let them get nukes, we'll stop them at the water's edge. I think that yields to both the national security argument, we can't have this, and the political cycle. What I need is a crisis to revive my
popularity. But, Jack, that seems extreme, playing politics with nuclear war?
Well, I mean, I'm just telling you that you've got to say, why are they letting it drift? Why haven't they agreed to talk to these people bilaterally, as they've asked, have a general stand down? Is it just because this is what Bill Clinton did and they can't repeat Clinton? Then, I think they're letting this just peter out, and they're trying to show the allies out there, you can't talk to these people. Look at this. They're proliferating now. We've got to stop them. I'm just terribly afraid that he's reaching the point where he won't have any other option. And that option, the option of force, will also coincide with his political necessities.
Jack Beatty, Paul Bracken, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Jonathan Pollack. He's chairman of the Strategic Research Department at the Naval War College. He joins us from Newport, Rhode Island tonight. Good evening and welcome, Jonathan Pollack.
Good evening.
Jonathan Pollack, we'd like to bring this right up to date. You've heard Jack Beatty just saying he sees a drift in the White House. He's tempted to see it as a deliberate drift, and yet on the other hand, this is not an easy problem to solve, and no one wants to jump in with both feet. How do you bring us right up to date as far as you can? How do you interpret what is being described from many sides now as a kind of lack of clear policy by the White House? Is there a standoff between, I don't know, State Department and the Pentagon and the White House? Do we have some kind of standoff that is keeping a clearer policy from coming out, or is this just a deliberate low profile as the administration tries to work through this?
Well, there are a lot of factors at play here, but I think we have to begin with President Bush personally. He has made very clear, almost from the outset of his administration, that he did not want to deal with North Korea. He certainly didn't want to negotiate directly with them. And as several have already said, his statements over the course of 2002 contributed further fuel to that fire. So, you know, again, if you think about North Korea, I mean, even paranoids have real enemies. Yeah. And I think that may be the case we are in. Now, the question here of how dangerous or dire it is what people can differ on. You can differ either because you evaluate differently the technical capabilities that North Korea has. When Bill Perry offers the forecast that he does, he's doing the math. He's making a calculation based on what we know North Korea to have in the way of spent fuel rods, and he's making a calculation that if they should choose to reprocess, how much plutonium would that yield for nuclear weapons? I'm not saying that that's a dangerous situation. It isn't a dangerous situation. It is. The question, though, would be, what are North Korea's ultimate purposes in acquiring nuclear weapons? And my own view is that the fundamental purpose driving it is deterrence. It is an added measure of security for the North Korean state, which is isolated, vulnerable, devoid of any serious security allies, and legitimately worried about, you know, what the United States may mean by the words that it offers.
Are you suggesting as deterrence, and with that suggesting that Washington might accept this and say, oh, that's all right, that's just Pyongyang's deterrence instrument?
Well, no one in the administration is going to say it as such, although there have been intimations of it, including, I might add, by the president himself when he met with Prime Minister Howard at the Texas White House several months ago. Secretary of State Powell also at different times has implied as much. The problem would be, do you mean that literally? Do you mean that whatever North Korea might choose to do, whatever it chooses to assemble, is something that the United States will live with? Or is there some kind of a threshold, or some have put it, a red line beyond which we simply cannot tolerate and will not tolerate what they do, irrespective of the consequences?
And just in the 20 seconds we have before the break, you're a strategy guy. Can the United States and its allies in Northeast Asia tolerate a nuclear-armed North Korea?
Well, the president has opted not to negotiate with the North, where there would be at least a modest possibility of getting constraints on what North Korea is doing, perhaps even being able to refreeze some aspects of what they have underway. By choosing not to do that, you in fact make much more likely that they do acquire those weapons.
Wow, so a line may be crossed, but Washington may not call it a red line. We're talking tonight about warnings of a quickening American drift toward war with North Korea. You can join the conversation. Are you ready for another war on the Korean Peninsula? Do the mounting warnings sound reasonable or overwrought to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about warnings of a quickening American drift toward war with North Korea. My guests tonight are Jonathan Pollack, chairman of the Strategic Research Department at the Naval War College, joining us from Newport, Rhode Island, and Yale professor of management and political science, author of Fire in the East, Paul Bracken, joining us tonight from Los Angeles. You can join us as well should the United States accept a nuclear-armed North Korea. Does the Bush administration's quiet on the subject make a nuclear Pyongyang more likely or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul Bracken, if I may turn to you, you just heard Jonathan Pollack in effect suggest that the Bush administration may find it the wiser path or the more expedient path, call it what you will, to, as I hear this, look the other way just a little bit, to sit while a nuke is developed here. This is a new strategy, is it not?
I would agree with Jonathan Pollack on that. I mean, I don't think you would ever get the administration to agree with that. But I think it is entirely possible that through inaction, whether it's because we're diverted to Liberia, Iraq, et cetera, or other factors, that we could mishandle this and just stay where we are, which is with a concerted economic warfare program against North Korea, which really doesn't do very much.
And that would constitute mishandling in your mind?
That would constitute mishandling because you're not thinking through where you're going to take this two or three steps up this, you know, this ladder that I've been talking about, where you increase the intensity of the crisis.
Well, describe that for us. Is being the policy at the moment is being described not as a blitzkrieg, but a sitzkrieg, kind of administration sitting on its hands on this front. If there is a tacit acceptance of North Korean nuclear weapons, if they're not there already, take us up that ladder. What are the strategic implications?
Well, first of all, I don't think that's a fair. I don't think sitzkrieg is fair. There's certain steps you have to go through in order to go through other steps. You can't just launch a military strike on North Korea without a massive effort first to, you know, assemble a diplomatic coalition.
But you're the one who said it's been several months that they have not apparently figured out what to do next, and I guess that's what's being characterized as a
sitzkrieg.
That's
right. Look, my one-line summary here is that, you know, consider you have major problems. We're all familiar with it at places where we work, that they just don't address major problems. And my view of what's going on.
But they're not nuclear problems in our workplace.
No, that's true. I know, but, you know, one of the things I've learned is that the degree to which the running the local deli, the people run the country pretty much the same way. The significance of the problems is a lot greater, but the behavior is often quite the same.
Walk us through the implications. If North Korea clearly has nuclear weapons and everybody knows it, what does that mean?
What it means is that people have been thinking if they have a very small number, two or three nuclear weapons, you could still, in the worst case, have a conventional war, which we would win. If North Korea has 20, 30 or more nuclear weapons, this radically changes our plans, because then you have to consider the damage that a war would cause on South Korea and, unfortunately, for Japan. If you don't think about where you're going to go here, if you just sort of stay stuck on you've intensified the crisis through economic actions, diplomatic isolation, and some other mechanisms. But if you just sit on that for several months while North Korea is manufacturing these weapons, then you're faced with a large arsenal. And then, is where I come out, you could say, this is too hard to solve. Now, let me just, I personally would really not, I think this is a very unfortunate thing to do, but I'm not in the government.
Too hard to solve and accept nuclear weapons in North Korea. Paul Bracken, Jonathan Pollack, stand by. We're joined right now from Washington by David Sanger of the New York Times. David Sanger, good evening and welcome.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. David, you've been following closely the consideration, as closely as it can be followed, within the administration of what to do about North Korea. We're reading and hearing tonight of a certain degree of administration paralysis, if I'm reading it correctly, around this issue. What's the latest? Where does this stand? Is there a standoff over policy on North Korea?
Well, the president just was asked about it today. I was down in Crawford. We just got back to Washington. And his attitude was very much of, there's nothing new here. We've known the North Koreans are developing nuclear weapons. What is new here, though, is, as your panel has just discussed, is we're at that tipping point where you move from two possible weapons to six or eight, depending on how many you believe they may either have or be about to obtain. And that's a big difference, because with two, there's not a whole lot you can do. Mm-hmm. With six or eight, you can test one, you can tuck a few away in the mountains where we're not likely to hit them, and you have a few left over to sell to your friends.
Friends who William Perry had it last week might include terrorists who would set one off in an American city.
Well, I mean, I guess so. The fact of the matter is, we have not seen North Korea sponsor much terrorism in recent years, but certainly that is the big fear, because let's face it, North Korea has never had a weapon system that it did not ultimately sell. Now, so far, it's always been missiles or conventional weapons, but that's the way it's worked.
President Bush can say there's nothing new here, but we certainly read about a lot popping out, and we hear of again, what sounds like a standoff inside the administration. What can you tell us about that? Are there differing views within the administration about how this ought to be handled?
There are. I mean, there were most differing views were in the fall, when the question was, would you talk to the North Koreans at all? And Secretary Powell won that argument, and they agreed to go off and begin some talks. But when they began them, it was with the warning that we had detected a secret nuclear program that, in fact, they had obtained in part from Pakistan. And the North Koreans, rather than deny it, said, yeah, we've got that and more. And that began this long decline where the North Koreans threw out the inspectors. So now we have very little sense of actually what is going on in these two very separate nuclear programs. Mm. The fact that there are two programs means you have an added complication. It means you have more to dismantle diplomatically, and if it came to military action, it means you have more things to take out, many of which we don't know where to locate it.
David Sanger, you and Tom Shanker have written in the Times that the administration, including head of the CIA George Tenet, have gone to extraordinary lengths to avoid calling this nuclear confrontation a crisis. Is it, in fact, a crisis that's simply not being given the name?
Well, if your concern a few months ago was Saddam Hussein's nuclear program that might produce a weapon between 2005 and 2009, and that was a crisis, and North Korea's situation where they might produce more weapons between now and, say, October, you know, you do the math. They're not calling it a crisis for a very good reason. They think that the North Koreans want to create a crisis here and want to get into a blackmail situation where there is pressure on the United States to give them something. And they very much don't want to get into that position.
And what about a potential political calculus around this potential standoff? We spoke with former General Wesley Clark, a potential Democratic presidential candidate, a couple of weeks ago. He suggested that the Bush administration, as Jack Beatty reminds us tonight, has crises teed up to kick off, if need be, to help the Bush presidential campaign. Does that sound outrageous to you? Or
you know, the other way to look at that is that they have crises they want to avoid between now and then, that, you know, the political shop in the White House may be saying, you know, we've had two wars in 2.5 years. Let's cool it till we get to the far side of the election.
And maybe that's a good idea. David Sanger, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
David Sanger of the New York Times. He co-wrote the story in Sunday's paper about evidence that North Korea has built a second secret plant for processing weapons-grade plutonium. Jonathan Pollack, how about it? A tipping point here in the president's characterization of nothing new going on. Are we near a tipping point? Is it a fair characterization, nothing new, or is this tamping down the issue to try and deal quietly with it?
Well, the piece that Tom Shanker and David Sanger wrote this Sunday was really quite extraordinary, not the least of which because It is not confirmed intelligence, at least as they characterize it. Indeed, according to them, it hasn't even been extensively briefed at the higher levels of the U.S. government. So we're treated to the extraordinary spectacle, to intelligence disclosure in the pages of the New York Times.
And sort of raw intelligence at that.
And you know, again, North Korea, I know people find it a very, very odd and mysterious place, but frankly, I don't find the North Koreans all that obscure to understand. In a tactical sense, we often may have some difficulty, but in a strategic sense, it's pretty clear. What they want from the United States and what Bush is not going to give them, at least under prevailing circumstances, is first what I'll call legitimation, simply stating unambiguously that the United States regards the DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, as a legitimate sovereign state. The second thing they want is security assurances, which Bush also doesn't want to give them, although at different times we have said we have no plans to invade or attack North Korea. And finally, they want some unspecified help with their economic and energy situation. So the president cannot countenance any kind of repeat of what he sees that was undertaken under the Clinton administration. The problem, however, is that if you ask where we are now, today, in July of 2003, mm-hmm. and compare where we were in July of 2002, what the North Koreans have done is, given that the United States declared that it found North Korea in default on its commitments, we indicated that we would no longer supply the heavy fuel oil to the North. So the North said, fine, watch this. And they proceeded to undo every single bit of constraint that was imposed on their program in 1994. And although I don't want to suggest that the agreed framework has worked perfectly, it's a somewhat convoluted agreement, the guts of it, the essential trade, held for 8 full years. And North Korea did not begin taking these steps until the United States declared it would no longer provide the fuel oil.
So again, back to basic strategy, does this add up? It may feel good to say we will not legitimize this regime, we will not give them security guarantees, but is that worth the risk of North Korean nuclear weapons that could hit China, South Korea, Japan, that could end up via trade, smuggling, you name it, within the United States? Is it worth it? Is this a good strategic trade-off?
Well, you know, again, I think that it's hard to know exactly what the precise calculation and whether there's a uniform calculation in the Bush administration. I don't think that there is. I do think that some, and David Sanger alluded to that before, particularly Secretary of State Powell, has at least tried to keep some options in the air to go down a different path. Because when the administration says it seeks a diplomatic solution, frankly, that's a contrivance. A diplomatic solution involves diplomacy. It involves negotiation. What the administration is really doing is pursuing a strategy of diplomatic consultation, but not with North Korea, because that's where we don't want to go. Now, they're assuming either A, that the North Koreans may not have as much in their inventory as some people fear that they do, that they would not be able to reconstitute their program fully, or alternatively, they believe that ultimately North Korea will do things that are deemed so objectionable that others, including China, will bring incredible pressure to bear on the North. That might include, for example, indications that North Korea is actively pursuing the marketing of either plutonium or a finished weapon abroad. Now, frankly, that is probably the only identifiable so-called red line that I can see. I think in some sense, and Paul Bracken put it well, you know, the administration's kind of kicking the can down the road on the assumption that they may not have to face those worst of horribles in the not-too-distant future. And, of course, the ultimate hope may be, the ultimate vision, if you will, is that North Korea will simply at some point come unglued. Now, frankly, that's been predicted
for a long time,
for many, many years, and it hasn't happened. It's in a remarkably durable regime.
I hear us hearing tonight that the red line may have moved, and that is a strategically fascinating idea. If suddenly it's all right for North Korea to have nuclear weapons. Jonathan Pollack, Paul Bracken, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome our callers in. Mark is calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
I'd like to make the comment that their entire nuclear program is against previously signed treaties. So anything that Washington does, it's kind of a moot point because they've already proven that they're not going to keep their word. Now, your host is saying that that it's acceptable or maybe acceptable or we may accept that North Korea has nuclear weapons for a defense or for a counterbalance or a deterrent.
That's what we're hearing in effect from some of our guests this evening, yeah.
Right. But earlier this year when the CIA had said, well, Korea may have one or two weapons, they haven't test-fired them, they may or may not be able to get here, they can probably hit California, Korea immediately fired back and said, I can hit any city within the North American continent whenever we feel like it. And as a deterrent factor, I think what Americans have to factor in is North Korea also made the statement earlier this year that they would take economic sanctions as an act of war. So we're dealing with people who are calling economic sanctions an act of war. Oh, we got to use our deterrent now.
Mark, are you suggesting that it's good for the United States to lean back from this and give it some time, or that it should lean in and try and deal with it, negotiate, whatever?
I think that we need to act now, because just like your caller from your host from Washington said, Paul, you know, the proliferation of nuclear weapons is completely unacceptable, no matter who they get to, and. North Korea has sold every nuclear, and I'm sorry, not nuclear, every weapons program they've had. You know, the Alsamu-2 is a variant of a North Korean rocket.
They've sold a lot. Mark, thank you for your call. Jack Beatty, what do you hear as you hear these observations and our caller here? The red line perhaps moving, the Bush administration perhaps deterred from dealing with North Korea by Liberia.
Yes, by Liberia, by yet another intervention. But also, you know, look at the interaction of these crises. The preemptive strike on Saddam really had to get the attention of the North Koreans. I mean, you know, we know now that this was done on very, very patchy. We have no weapons of mass destruction. And yet we went for this massive war. We're going for a multi-billion-dollar occupation. That preemptive strike, first time we've done that in our history. I just think now that that's been done, that maybe a card has been played that is irrevocable, that the North Koreans have just said to themselves, well, we have to get armed. We have to get armed quickly, because only nuclear weapons can keep the Americans from doing this again to us, doing to us what they did to Saddam. Mm-hmm. So I think the two crises really have worked one with the other to really make the North Korean situation much worse than it was.
Paul Bracken, do you see that interaction, that the North has concluded that a nuclear deterrent is the only way to remain secure?
Absolutely. I think we were talking earlier about, you know, what's new. Is this the same old thing, as President Bush apparently said today? But one other factor is the U.S. Army is now pinned down in Iraq and Afghanistan and Liberia, and I guess it could go on and on. I must say, it's the first time in a long time I've seen people in Washington actually lose sleep over an issue. That is to say, you know, it's okay for a Secretary of Defense or a President to talk about grave national issues, but most of the time they don't really lose sleep over it. It's rhetoric. I'm seeing right now, particularly in the Defense Department, a real loss of sleep. People are really staying up late at night wondering, what are we going to do if war breaks out on the peninsula? Because our army is just is strewn all over the world.
That is not a comforting thought or a comforting image. We'll come back and look more at the why of those sleepless nights in Washington over North Korea. We're looking tonight at a quickening drift toward potential war on the Korean Peninsula, potential nuclear war. You can join the conversation. Will ignoring North Korea make it go away? And is there a way to fight a war in North Korea, or should negotiation be the path? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Support for this program. On Point, we're talking tonight about new, fresh warnings of a quickening American drift toward war with North Korea. Former Defense Secretary William Perry saying last week, time is running out, and each month the problem gets more dangerous. Our guests tonight from Yale University, Paul Bracken, and from the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, Jonathan Pollack. Our own Jack Beatty is here as well. Jay is calling from Salem, New Hampshire. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I've been listening intently, and one of the things that you just concluded the last piece with was not whether we should do it, but perhaps can we do it. Our forces are committed globally. The Army is having a great deal of difficulty identifying follow-on forces to relieve those combat forces in place. And when we look at the long-term occupation and apparent lack of planning for this in the places that we find ourselves, be it Afghanistan or Iraq, and in my past, places like Panama and Haiti, you look to say, well, okay, if we were to do the action, do we have the forces necessary? If we do, we're going to have to call up an awful lot of reserve forces. The fighting.
Jay, do you have a military background? If so, what?
Yes, I'm a retired Marine Corps intelligence officer, and I've been out now for about 10 years.
But when you look around the world right now, are you suggesting you don't see the American capacity to deal with North Korea in a more active way, even if it was decided that was the best thing to do?
Exactly. I think that we do have a capacity, but it would have to be a full-tilt war effort akin to that of the World War II experience, where we're really bringing a lot more people on board. Because although global war plans call for fighting, you know, multiple fronts and multiple wars, we essentially have that now with the troops that committed to these other places, unless we can get relief from other nations, and that doesn't appear to be coming.
Well, there's an arresting thought. Jay, thanks for the call. Let me put it to you, Jonathan Pollack. We've heard about tipping points tonight. Is the United States at that kind of tipping point? We're really without some dramatic change in the level of commitment to forces abroad. It's simply not able to pick up in a more active way a challenge like North Korea's.
Well, it depends a lot on what kind of a war you would anticipate on the Korean Peninsula with what kinds of objectives. We have planned for the possibility of a second Korean War since the time that the first one ended 50 years ago this summer. To that extent, elaborate contingency plans have always been drawn up to try to maximize what we can do.
But Don Rumsfeld has backpedaled a bit from that two major wars simultaneous, hasn't he?
To an extent he has. He would certainly like to think of war options that would not involve such a profound commitment of resources on the ground. But, you know, North Korea is a very dug-in place. Indeed, even without nuclear weapons, we're talking about a war that would be unbelievably ugly. Let us remember that on any given day of the year, something slightly over 100,000 American citizens are resident in the Republic of Korea. So that kind of changes the calculation, even if North Korea didn't have anything that glows in the dark. So that's been the fundamental problem. Indeed, that's one of the reasons why, despite the profound dangers in Korea, a level of conventional armament that is exceedingly high, why, in fact, there has been no full-scale war for 50 years. It's an ugly deterrence, if you will, but it's a necessary deterrence. So the question now would be, if we posit that, I mean, if it is not, for example, in response to a North Korean attack on the South, but rather that we decide that there are simply unacceptable risks to our long-term national security posed by whatever North Korea does or does not have in its inventory, that would be a very, very different kind of war. I mean, in other words, if it were a North Korean-initiated attack, I would have to assume that our South Korean allies, who have a very substantial military force of their own, would be with us. But this is something very, very different we're talking about. And again, it's why the dangers here are that the forces are spread so thin that if you really, in effect, were asserting we have to go in and occupy North Korea, that may be quite literally a bridge too far.
It's kind of overwhelming. Paul Brecken, our time is short, but let me just put this to you. Might it not be the better part of valor or machismo or even strategy to negotiate with North Korea now?
I think anything which buys time and lowers the risk until we can get out of Iraq and establish a hedge in the event that there is war in Korea is a good thing. But let me make another point, and that is, let's not assume we're forgetting something here. North Korea is not the only country in the region that has nuclear weapons. The United States does, too. And that is an option that people, it's been sort of off the table. It's been unthinkable, if you will. But let me suggest that it's a little bit less unthinkable today than it was 2 months ago.
That is, to put too fine a point on it, an American nuclear attack on North Korea to take out, presumably...
No, in response if North Korea were to attack South Korea and we could not handle it with conventional forces.
So Bush may feel that he finally has that threat at hand. And with that, we're out of time. Paul Brecken, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Jonathan Pollack in Newport, Rhode Island, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Pollack is chairman of the Strategic Research Department at the Naval War College. Paul Bracken is professor of management and political science at Yale. Jack Beatty, what a picture yet again in North Korea. Your final thoughts.
Well, you know, I'm beginning to think that here Iraq looks like a strategic mistake. That is to say, we dealt with a peripheral threat that prevented us from dealing with a real and present danger.
Did we pick the right crisis here, in other words?
Yeah.
Well?
And did our picking crisis one worsen crisis two?
And just when you think things will cruise along, we hear tonight, well, that would require a commitment on the scale of World War II. No thanks. Let's pray things go another way. Jack Beatty, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, tempers flare in the 108th Congress. This is On Point. It began like many other humid summer Friday mornings in Washington. The 41-member House Ways and Means Committee convened to consider a bipartisan bill that would revise the nation's pensions and retirement savings system. Over the next few hours, that session turned into a bitter bipartisan battle with threats, insults, and even a call to the Capitol Police to remove committee Democrats. When the dust cleared, House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi berated the Republicans for calling the cops in to settle a congressional dispute.
The fact is, they don't know what's right and they don't know what's wrong. They don't know the difference. They still have to be convinced that it isn't right for a member of Congress to call the police on his colleagues to evict them from a room.
But Illinois Republican Committee member Jerry Weller later defended Ways and Means Chair Bill Thomas, Republican from California, for bringing order to the House.
I asked the question during debate, what would I have done? If I was chairman, if I had a member of our committee who was threatening another member with bodily harm, who is using invective, innuendo, and name-calling against another member of the committee. And clearly, Mr. Thomas made the right decision.
Joining us now from Washington are Juliet Alpern, congressional reporter for The Washington Post, and NPR congressional correspondent David Wellnow. Juliet, you were in the library with the Democrats in this famous standoff on Friday. Give us a sense of what was going on in this bitter circus. What launched all this?
It started with something which happens quite a lot, which is that the Republicans only gave a draft of the bill that the committee, the Ways and Means Committee, would be considering to the Democrats shortly before midnight the night before. And so Democrats were upset that they didn't have a longer amount of time to review the bill, and essentially insisted on a parliamentary tactic, which is that a clerk had to read the entire substance of this bill.
So this was 90 pages long. The Republican chairman, Bill Thomas of California, wasn't happy about this. And
exactly.
Then what ensued?
What happened is that essentially almost all the Democrats decamped into a room that's adjacent to the Ways and Means Committee. It's an ornate library, and they all plotted strategy there while this reading continued, and they left one designee, Pete Stark of California, to stay there just to keep an eye on Republicans and make sure that they didn't push ahead and consider this bill. This infuriated Bill Thomas, the chairman, who called on the Capitol Police to evict the Democrats from the library, which technically is under his control.
This brings to mind the Texas legislature and the legislators fleeing to Oklahoma and having the police sent back to them. Was he serious? Did he really expect the Capitol Police would drag them out of the Ways and Means Library?
It's hard to tell because he has refused to answer any questions or comment at all since all of this has transpired. But I don't think he called them just as a bluff. I mean, I think he assumed that they would leave once the police showed up, which, of course, they were unwilling to do.
The cameras came in and there was quite a to-do. How did the police respond?
Well, the police, as you might imagine, felt quite uncomfortable being put in this position. And so a couple officers came, then they brought in a supervisor, then they kicked it up to the sergeant-at-arms office, which is kind of the top police officer, in a sense, for Capitol Hill. And the sergeant-at-arms ruled that this was not a matter for his office, that this was something that the members had to work out amongst themselves.
Meanwhile, we have things erupting in what reads at this point like a kind of mayhem. Pete Stark, who was left behind, is reported shouting at Representative Scott McInnes, Colorado Republican, calling him a little wimp and saying, come on, come over here and make me. I dare you, you little fruitcake, you little fruitcake. I said you are a fruitcake. David Wellner, this whole thing spilled right on over into the general session of the House that afternoon. What happened?
Well, at that general session, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi introduced a resolution that condemned what had happened and asked that the hearing be held again and also that there be some kind of apology from the committee chairman, Bill Thomas. So there was a very lengthy and angry debate that followed that. And in that debate, details came out about what was going on back in the committee room when these Democrats were cloistered in the library.
Yes.
And one thing everybody agrees on is that Pete Stark, the Democrat, stayed behind to raise objections on behalf of his Democratic colleagues. In these committees, you can't proceed unless you get the consent of all the members. And if somebody says, I object, mm-hmm. then you can't go forward to the next step. And that was Pete Stark's role. When this substitute bill was being read very slowly and all the Republicans wanted to get out and get off to their weekend, the chairman, Bill Thomas, at one point he said, without objection, it is considered as read. And Stark said, I object. Now, this is according to the official transcript. And Thomas said, well, the gentleman was too late. And,
the gavel was down already.
The gavel down. And you know, this is the kind of thing that has infuriated Democrats. And Republicans, of course, on the floor reminded Democrats that when they were in the minority, this kind of thing went on all the time, too. So, in a sense, it was payback. But Thomas has a reputation, not just among Democrats, among his fellow Republicans, too, for the very condescending way he addresses his fellow members. He's known to be extremely prickly. And I think this was quite embarrassing for a lot of his Republican colleagues, as well as infuriating for the Democrats.
So by the time the whole House was on fire over this, Democrats are saying Republicans are running a police state, Republicans mm-hmm. are saying Democrats are way out of line. Juliet, what's going on here? What has heated things up to such an uncivil level in the 108th Congress?
Well, obviously, things have been partisan for quite a while, but I think what you're really seeing is the simmering over frustration by Democrats who feel completely marginalized in the 108th Congress. They simply do not matter. Legislatively, they are ignored, they are pushed aside, and this was a moment where they saw an opportunity to really fight back in a very public way. The Republicans, with a 12-seat majority at this point, are really not nearly as dependent as they had been even a couple years ago on Democratic votes to pass legislation. And as a result, they've been marginalizing the Democrats consistently over the past 6 months.
But it's never been a Tea Party in the U.S. Congress, David Wellner. Are there breaches of etiquette or longstanding tradition that are going on here in the way Republicans are using their power, or is this just turnabout's fair play?
Well, I asked around, and nobody could remember any committee chairman actually calling the Capitol Police to evict members of the opposition party from his own committee. But there have been lots of other flare-ups recently on the Senate side as well, especially in the Senate Judiciary Committee. There are lots of tensions that go on in the House, partly because of the way the House is structured. Democrats really have almost nothing to say about what happens, as Juliet mentioned. They're shut out of the process. In many ways, it almost looks like a charade what goes on over there, because the Republicans get together and decide what the rules will be for each bill that they consider beforehand, whether they're going to even allow amendments or not. And if they just decide to pass a rule that shuts out the Democrats, that's the way it is. The House is not really that much of a deliberative body. In the Senate, on the other hand, the minority does have a lot more power and can really tie things up. That's sort of the source of bitterness on the Senate side. So you have almost opposite reasons for these sour feelings, but you certainly have them on both sides of the Capitol.
Well, on Friday, that power and that frustration boiled over into kind of mayhem, bitter name-calling. Juliet Alpern, you quote Republican Representative Ray LaHood of Illinois, saying this is one of the saddest days he had seen in the House, a kind of new low. But there it is. Juliet Alpern, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And David Wellner, wonderful to have you. Thanks for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
Juliet Alpern is Congress reporter for The Washington Post. David Wellner is NPR congressional correspondent. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program